I'm Tamara Thomas, editor-in-chief of UrbanHealthToday.com, part of the DocWire family of medical news sites, and I want to thank you for tuning in to Urban Health Weekly. Our goal each week is to keep you informed of the latest in health and medical news right from today's headlines. It's time to empower yourself with open conversations about your medical care with news that matters to you. So are you ready? Let's get started. I'm here with my friends Jackie and Louis, and let's jump into it today. Oh, but before we jump into it, can I just, I just wanted to tell you guys, I know I have to hog like the first 3 to 5 minutes, but I just wanted to share some good news.
Ooh.
And the good news is, one, I finally did the colonoscopy. And the doctor was like, I'll see you in 10 years. And I was like, oh, 5 years. Hey, you don't need to. I was like, yeah, I know, but I'm black, so I'm the
okay.
But that was I just wanted to put a cap.
That's fantastic.
Thank you. Since that was like a thing that was and by the way, my prep was wonderful. It was excellent prep, he said. Research.
I love when they say that.
There you go.
I know, it was very ungratifying. But I just wanted to put a pin in that because that was like an ongoing saga.
So yes.
I like that. But what I wanted to tell you is I started cycling. I didn't think that I was a cycling type of person.
Wait, like on a stationary bike? Like on a Peloton?
Well, we're the same names.
They're not sponsors yet. Okay. If they do want to sponsor, if you're out there, we will make it that bike, okay?
we're not saying any names, right. But yes, it's a stationary bike with a screen, with programs. And, I didn't think that I would enjoy it as much as I have. I'm about 3 weeks in. And I am absolutely loving it. I didn't think that I would, because I'm a yoga girl.
I have a question on that.
Yeah.
Does the time fly by, or do you feel every second of it?
That's a really good question. When I first started doing it, I felt like the first 5 minutes, because I only do 20 minutes at a pop. Mm-hmm. I don't do like 30 or 45 minutes. I'm
pacing. Okay.
Until I meet certain goals, and then I'll start doing longer programs. But the first 5 minutes you feel, and then the 10 minutes goes by so quickly, and then you already kind of hit a stride, and then like the last 5 minutes you're kind of like
tortured.
No, you're kind of like, no, because it starts to cool down and you start
feeling,
I could probably do another 10 minutes of this.
Okay.
Are you feeling
righteous when you get off? Do you feel like I accomplished something? Do you feel good when you get done with that thing?
I feel sweaty.
Yes, that's good.
And I feel, I don't know. I mean, how do you feel when you get off of it?
Well, in all the thousands of classes that I've taken, which is like maybe 30,
pure rubbish.
It's painful. You kind of get through it, but at a certain point, you just keep going. You know.
See, I don't feel like. I'm never.
How is it on the knees? Like, can you sit? Does it cut off the circulation to like your legs? Like, does it hit the femoral artery when you're sitting on that thing? Does it hurt your knees to be doing that?
As a man, yes.
No.
I'm going to say what it hurts, but after 20 minutes.
No.
Not for you.
The seat initially was a bit of a problem, I think.
Yeah, because you have to adjust it, right? Because I had a problem years ago when I did cycling, and I was like, man, I can't do it. I'm killing my knees.
I finally found the right position, though. And now that I found the right position, it's zero problems. I don't like I would wad up a towel. When I first started, I would wad up a towel under my tush.
Yes.
Make like a makeshift cushion. Once I fixed the settings and I found the right settings, it's not an issue anymore. I was worried about that. I was worried that, my knee would be an issue.
Right.
That I would be like exhausted afterward. I'm not going to lie. I have had to take naps in the afternoon.
That's a good sign. Are you doing it first thing in the morning?
I'm doing it for, well, not first thing in the morning. First thing in the morning is I got to get Lizzie ready for school, but
Second.
Yes,
absolutely.
Okay, second question.
Hydrated as hell when I do it.
Okay, because it's sweaty and that, which is good. Sweaty's good.
Yes.
Second question, do you dread going to it or do you feel like a little bit excited going to it in the morning?
You know, I do it every other day. I don't do it every day.
Ah, okay.
So I, because I pace myself, I'm very neutral. So I, you know, when I go to it, there's no feeling of dread, but it's also not like, oh my God, I can't wait to get back on the stage.
Okay. But, that's a manageable feeling, that one. But so it's not like, ugh.
Right.
Okay.
But then after, it's not a dread. But the other cool thing about it is it, you have other classes besides the cycling. You have, you've got bar, you've got high intensity. So anyway, it's just super enjoyable. Okay. I didn't think I would.
Do you need special shoes? Do you need special shoes?
Yeah. Well, well, there's two sides to the pedal. There's one side where you use the special shoes and there's the other side where you just kind of shove your.
Oh, okay.
But I love it. I didn't think I would, but now it's like
anything that gets you exercising and it's not so torturous and it's productive. And
it's not, yeah, but I don't find it torturous at all. I find it.
That's huge.
You know, I find it very gratifying, you know, and then afterwards I'll do like some yoga and then, you know, that's it. So I just wanted to share that I'm now officially a cycling lover, which I thought would happen in my life, but here I am. So there.
Okay. Very nice. I like it.
So let's get into the medical news of the week. Well, as we know right now, October is Breast Cancer Month. So I first wanted to give a special shout out to all of my cancer survivors, cancer sufferers, and their relatives. In breast cancer news, I've got some encouraging news and some not so good news. So let's start with some good news. The good news is modern medicine has made breast cancer much more survivable. Thanks to advances in breast cancer treatment, the stage one breast cancer survival rate is roughly around 98%.
Fantastic.
Yes. Stage two is also in the 90s. And at stage three, survival rates dip into the 70% range. But that's still pretty up there, I think, 70%. Once you get into stage four, we'll see what's happening to Shannon Doherty. I don't want to. So what are some of these modern medicine changes? Well, improvements in genomic testing has enabled doctors to assess whether or not a patient will benefit from chemotherapy, possibly avoiding its potential side effects. Also, doctors have systemic treatment at their disposal, which treats the entire body instead of just the cancer-affected area. So doctors can now determine if patients will be helped by chemotherapy, antibody therapy, anti-estrogen therapy, or a combination of them all. Researchers are also improving the ability to identify hereditary cancer syndrome. Doctors can now identify patients who might have increased risk of breast cancer in addition to the BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene mutations. Obviously, this is fantastic news, but what about prevention education? I think most breast cancer patients would prefer not to get disease to begin with, right?
Right.
ASCO PUB's expert article report estimates that successful diet and lifestyle changes could prevent 25 to 30% of cases of breast cancer. The jury's still out, of course, on BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene carriers, but I'm sure they couldn't hurt. What do you guys think?
Well, I think that's fantastic news to start out with. I mean, that's very reassuring. It makes me remember that I have not been getting my exams regularly and I got to schedule that. And, you know, I have to get over my fear. Yes.
You got to stop playing. Anyway.
I got to stop playing. Absolutely. I got to get on that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd also be curious to know with the genomic testing, who covers the genomic testing? If you have like really lousy insurance, is it covered?
Well, you know, every state has different rules about what insurance must cover. So I imagine, you know, with the push for ending breast cancer and breast cancer awareness and all of this research that, you know, I'm sure there are multiple states that have rules that insurance must pay for certain things that are going to, you know, treat and prevent and, and circumvent.
Treat and prevent. Does that include the genomic testing, or is that just?
So, for example, when I did the testing for
right,
and they found out that I had the BRCA. My mother had died of breast cancer.
Yes.
My father had died of prostate cancer, and so that triggers the insurance in New York here that they must pay for my genetic testing.
Right.
Okay.
Now that's genetic testing pre-cancer. Now,
yes.
Now,
right. Now, what happens when you have cancer and you need the genetic testing to say what's the best testing for treatment? Go ahead.
My advice, even though I'm not a clinician and I've been warned in prior episodes not to say that I'm not a clinician because I do sound like a doctor.
You're not a clinician.
But my advice is that prior to starting treatment, you do some research into your options that your insurance will cover, meaning what, you know, is it Mount Sinai? Is it NYU? What places are you covered for? And the reason for that is in the treatment of cancer, I feel as a layperson,
yes,
that the community approach is extremely important. By community, meaning it's not just your doctor telling you what to do. It's a lot of people that help you fill out the insurance, people that help you navigate what drugs to take. That whole ecosystem or community oncology process, which includes the PA, the nurse practitioner, the geneticist, right, et cetera, is extremely important to survival and to your long-term mental health. Because, you know, you can go to the doctor and depending on that doctor, he may tell you, well, you've got aggressive blah, blah cancer. What does that mean? You know, and what does stage one mean? What does stage two? What do all these terms mean? We all have the internet, but someone who's an HCP, a healthcare professional, should be able to sit you down and explain to you what these terms are, what your options are, what insurance does and does not cover, and what things you can do on your own that may or may not be expensive. So those are all very, very important stages of treatment. And
so is that the social worker at the hospital? I feel like New York has a really good system. It's a hospitalist or the patient advocate?
Yes, but you know what? The oncology department is its own.
They're their own force. They have it set up.
They have everything set up. They have their entire ecosystem of everything. They talk to you about the insurance. Mm-hmm. They talk to you about, there's a person for everything. There's someone.
Is that the oncology department in general or the breast oncology?
That's the breast oncology. But every oncology department, more or less, I'm going to speak mostly for breast oncology from my experience.
Yeah, because my experience was not that for, you know, in New Jersey for uterine, you know, that was not. So I'm curious to know but that was my particular hospital. So I would find that very helpful if I'd had the social worker and everybody or a hospitalist, you know, or the whole center. So in New York, your experience was that your breast cancer specialist had a whole infrastructure set up.
A whole team.
There's
a whole team. There's the team that does, you know, all of the screening, you know, the MRI, the ultrasound and all of that. There's the person that you talk to about the insurance. There's the person that comes in, the nurse practitioner, you know, or the nurse. There's the breast oncologist. There's all of these people. Mm-hmm. And all of them deal specifically with that condition, with breast cancer, whatever kind of breast cancer. And so that's my experience here in New York is pick a hospital. They've all got their system.
Yep.
And I like that.
It's a very well-oiled system.
Yeah. And
more or less.
And for men,
men,
what happens is typically your prostate cancer, let's start with the most common, which is prostate cancer.
Yeah.
Your prostate cancer is caught by the urologist. Now, in many instances, your urologist is not going to want to turn you over to the oncology center and all that. They want to keep you as a patient for whatever reason. Sometimes I want to think that it's always well-intentioned, but there's a profit incentive too that kind of helps your intentions. So once you turn that patient over, you stop having billable hours, et cetera, et cetera. Whether that pertains or not to your doctor, who knows? But it's always good that you then get passed on to a specialist, at least, so that the two of them can talk, and then you enter that community system. So, you know, to give my advice again, it's sort of like, one, try to find out where it is that you're going and who it is that's in charge of the team here, and try to get that community treatment so that you can get different perspectives. Your options are explained to you before, not just your urologist telling you, well, we're going to do this one with hormone and this and this and this.
Right. And they're just kind of throwing as many darts as they can to see what
you're throwing without you knowing what the aggressiveness factor is, without you knowing what your options and treatment are, and choices that you as a patient should be able to make.
Now, I'm not sure what to tell people in smaller. So talk about your experience, because you said that your experience in your hospital system.
Right. It was my particular hospital system, and it was a women's health center within the hospital. And I don't know if it's just because the infrastructure for breast cancer is so much more, you know, established than it is for, possibly. And I don't know, I had to keep walking over there because I worked in the building. So I had to keep walking over there to like get my calls back. It wasn't the best experience for me. So I don't know what they were going through, but my oncologist was not that, you know, easily accessible. The PA wasn't. So that was my particular experience. And, but I, you know, that was a long time ago, and that might not be the case for, well, it might've been that particular.
How long ago was not that long?
Let me think. Well, 2013. Okay. And also I wasn't like, you know, I was only stage 1B. So that might've been part of it too. Like, it was a big deal to me, but perhaps they didn't see it as such a big deal. And they took a very aggressive preventative, like prophylactic, they did the debulking and all that kind of thing. So they were just like, okay, one and done. So it's very possible that because it didn't appear terribly aggressive, like it might not have been like, it might not have been such a rush for them. It's very possible. Anyway. But what I like what you're saying is that New York and these hospitals have a lot of infrastructure set up to really help the patients and guide them through the whole procedure.
Right.
That I really appreciate, and the care.
And a lot more preventative and tissue sparing type procedures. Yeah, because, you know, a lot of the understanding now is like people don't want to just part with their organs necessarily if they don't have to.
Ah, yes. I would have preferred not to part with my organs if I didn't have to. That would have made me very happy. Okay. Oh.
And now
we got. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to move on to the nostalgia.
Yes. Okay.
Two new European studies have confirmed our worst suspicion. Aluminum salts found in deodorants and antiperspirants are potentially carcinogenic to breasts, meaning they're likely to lead to cancer.
Ugh.
Yeah. Researchers tested aluminum salts on mammalian mammary gland in vitro, meaning on you know, basically mammal breast cells in test tubes or on slides. And the test demonstrated that mammary tissue, quote, rapidly incorporated this metal, unquote. 24 hours after exposure to aluminum salt, the cells showed genomic instability, which is known to happen when malignancies form. And we all know that malignancy means cancer.
Yes.
The World Health Organization says that about 50% of breast cancers develop in women who have no identifiable risk factors other than just being female and being over 40 years of age.
Ooh.
That's kind of mind blowing. You know, I remember when I was a teenager, I used to watch my mom apply her deodorant. It was a popular brand roll on at the time. And I remember being disturbed. I just remember looking at her, watching her, and being disturbed by the large quantity she'd apply to her underarms. I just remember thinking, and I may have even asked her at one point, why did she need so much deodorant? I mean, it would be outside of her underarms. It was so much. And she was
okay.
And now hearing this brings me right back to that.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm lucky enough that, in a way, lucky enough that I'm kind of allergic to most dyes. So I never use deodorant. And I'm also lucky enough that I'm like the Korean leader. where I don't sweat, have any type of odors or anything like that. I'm just
boy, are you I'm lucky? Because
I'm just the chosen one, but
I'm the sweatiest person on the face of the earth. And for a while, I was not using those aluminum-free ones.
Yeah, but there's a reason why at the studio here we have a big divider where I have to sit on one. No one comes next to me.
Well, after this, I'm going to be throwing out my antiperspirant and getting back in gear and buying something that's aluminum free, because I think I have aluminum containing one upstairs. So that's my thing.
You know, the natural community has been up on this for a long time.
Yes. And I used to use aluminum free one.
Yeah. And a lot of the brands that make deodorant and antiperspirants are taking those ingredients out of them now. So
we don't know why the aluminum was in there, because I felt like years ago when I used the natural ones that they did not help. They didn't prevent the sweating. And I'm like the sweatiest person on the face of the earth. And I just felt like, gosh, my clothes are like everything's really damp. And it was just like unsightly. So I felt like it couldn't just be deodorant. It had to be antiperspirant. So do they now have antiperspirants that work that don't have aluminum?
I don't know. I think just deodorants that are free of, I can't imagine you could make an antiperspirant without some sort of aluminum. I just don't.
So that might be the essential ingredient that makes it an antiperspirant.
It's possible that
well, then you know what? We're all just going to have to live with like wet pits and be like, you know, it's going to be the new okay. Because I'm not putting any aluminum in my pits anymore as of right now.
I stopped using deodorant years and years and years ago. And now I just use the natural deodorants. Deodorants. You know, the stuff you get at the health food store.
Okay.
The other thing I wanted to say is I went and I had a procedure called Mirror Dry.
Oh, yes.
So I zap my pits so I don't have sweaty pits anymore, and I don't have hair under my pits anymore either. So there's that. I'm not suggesting that people go out and spend that kind of money to do that, but you know, I used to stain my shirts, and that was
yes, that's torture. Yes.
My advice, and I'm not a clinician, my advice, if you have, you know, that kind of deodorant or antiperspirant, please do yourself
in the garbage. Yes.
Yeah. Delta Airlines is raising health insurance premiums for unvaccinated employees by $200 a month to cover higher COVID costs. Delta Airlines CEO Ed Bastian notified employees that they will face $200 monthly increases on their health insurance premiums starting November 1st. If they aren't vaccinated against COVID-19, citing steep costs to cover employees who are hospitalized with the virus, the company said in an announcement. The measures are the latest attempt by a U.S. corporation to drive COVID vaccination rates. Delta stopped short of an outright mandate like the one United Airlines instituted. What are our thoughts?
Well, what this ruling with the Pfizer vaccine being approved allows a company to do is to have selective rules. Before they couldn't be selective rules, but now you can say vaccinated people and unvaccinated people may be treated differently. Another case in point, Delta is a perfect example of this. And really the insurance industry is the one who's driving it, not Delta. Delta made a deal with the insurance industry. And that really helps the people that are vaccinated. It doesn't really penalize the people that are not. So there's different ways to think about this. Another way to think about this is, and again, if I look at something that's dear to me, is the NFL. The NFL is 90% vaccinated in most cases, but there's still a 10% of players that are holdouts. Those 10% players are subject to discipline. That the other 90% are not. So for example, if I'm not vaccinated, I don't wear a mask, I'm caught on camera not wearing a mask, I get a fine. And that's freaking out a lot of people in the NFL, and all sorts of blogs and tweets and things are going on. And of course, if your favorite player is fined, all of a sudden you can be outraged. But it's now legal to say, hey, student body left, student body right, whatever the student body right does not affect the student body left. And I'm going to institute two sets of rules. So we're looking at different ways of handling it. The Board of Ed said, hey, it's one flavor fits all. Everybody's got to get vaccinated, yada, yada, yada. Other people are saying, okay, we're not going to make a mandate here, but if you're not vaccinated, all of these things are going to happen to you and it's going to cost you more out of your pocket.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what's going to get people vaccinated?
Things like this.
Money.
Things like, yeah.
You think the punitive stuff where you're like the consequences.
Right. Because
as opposed to,
there are a lot of people, there are people who are avid anti people who are like, give me liberty or give me death by COVID.
Right.
And then there are right. a lot of people in the middle who are just like, I'll get around to it. I don't feel like doing it. But if you ask them more probing questions, they'll say, look, if it's going to cost me my job, I'll do it. If it means that I can't eat out, I'll do it. We have seen a rise in vaccination rates.
That's what I would like to know. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, because people are not feeling the pinch because now life is becoming convenient for them. When life is convenient and you don't have to make a decision, you don't make a decision. And then when the decision is taken out of your hands, people tend to do what they have to do. You want to eat in this restaurant? You got to get vaccinated. Otherwise, sit outside and shiver in the cold. My thoughts on the airlines thing is that the airlines have had a tough time maintaining any semblance of order since the pandemic grounded them and then coming back after, you know, the pandemic. And, you know, although people are flying again, there's still so many people that are not trusting to get on airlines and sit in a box with circulated air for however many hours in the air, where people are A, not behaving themselves, C, lying, you know, potentially about their COVID status, because a lot of that is on the honor system. You know, you read about these passenger scuffles where they're
it's like crazy.
You know, we shouldn't also have to worry that the flight crew and other customer-facing employees could be exposed or exposing us. That's my feeling about it. All right, let's take a break.
Okay.
Right back.
For human rights and social justice, WHIV 102.3 FM.
And we're back. Welcome back to Urban Health Weekly. And let's jump into our next topic, Merck's new antiviral molnupiravir.
Ah, that's how you say it.
Well, yeah, molnupiravir, yeah. It took me a while. I had to say it over and over and over, but molnupiravir.
I was actually going to introduce this one, and I said, nah, I think you could take it.
Well, molnupiravir, or MK-4482, is the newest addition to the war against COVID-19. It came out of Drug Innovation Ventures at Emory, or DRIVE, which is a not-for-profit LLC owned by Emory University. It had previously demonstrated broad-spectrum activity against other viruses such as influenza, Ebola, and a Venezuelan equine encephalitis virus. The work goes back to 2004 when Emory researchers were studying a related compound known as EIDD-1931/NHC. Then in March 2020, Ridgeback Biotherapeutics licensed the drug from DRIVE. Months later, Ridgeback licensed worldwide rights for EIDD-2801 for COVID-19 to Merck. Molnupiravir then received even more federal funding. In September 2021, the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, or BARDA, procured 1.7 million courses of the five-day regimen for $1.2 billion, or over $700 per treatment course.
Well, how much money is that they got?
Well, they got $1.2 billion, but on the front end, they got money. Well, they didn't get the money directly. The money was given to Emory's DRIVE
program. Okay.
For drug innovation. So that's where the molnupiravir, that's the origins of the molnupiravir. And that was paid for by the government. And then the government on the back end procured the 1.7 million courses of the five-day regimen for $1.2 billion.
Okay, just a little fact correction. The original research was funded but the government had nothing to do with it. It was funded, and Emory got a grant to do the research from the pharmaceutical industry.
Okay.
However, when, and then it just died there because there was no use for this thing. So for 16 years, that was money that you spent and nothing happened. And all of a sudden, we wound up getting COVID. So then at that point, the government said, hey, let's give some money here to see all these old things that were laying around in the gutter and all of that. And one of them worked out. And as a result, there was a bit of a windfall on this particular product, or will be a windfall, where, you know, now there's an order for 700, how much is it? 1.7 million doses.
Right, for $1.2 billion.
For $1.2 billion.
So it's, and it says $700 per treatment course is what's going to be.
$712 per treatment for five days of treatment per person.
Okay. Wow. Wow. It was important that there was all that money existing. Do you feel like that's what all that money that got spent ahead of time?
Between 2013 and 2020, the government awarded an estimated $35 million in grants to Emory Institute. Okay.
Right.
So that was the initial money that the government paid to Emory, who discovered and developed molnupiravir. So I'm not incorrect when I say that.
Right.
And the reason I'm bringing this back to Lou is because Lou always has this whole, you know, spiel about the R&D and cost money and, you know, always justifying the, you know, this drug has been federally funded up the wazoo
on the
back end by our tax.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Between 2002 and 2020, National Institutes of Health spent nearly $700 million on research funding for the technology underpinning these vaccines. So that's $700 million. And then there's another $35 million. Okay. So now what? You know, because an article from Stat News cites that the actual manufacturing cost for a five-day treatment course is estimated to be around $20.
$20,
which is a fraction of the unit cost of $712. And that price includes raw materials, okay? It includes the encapsulating of the medicine and the packaging of it. So please tell me where this R&D money, where the justification is for this price of $712 per treatment.
Okay, so this drug existed since 2004, okay? Let's do some math here.
Okay.
17 years, this thing just sat there in the warehouse, like the Indiana Jones warehouse. You remember that warehouse?
Yes.
That's not exactly what happened. Yeah. Ridgeback, we got into a little bit of trouble and they kept going back to the government for more money. And the government said, no, you already got enough money. And then
so
that's
when- You're saying that Ridgeback maybe mismanaged a little bit.
Yes. That's
okay.
Mark swooped in and actually made a product out of it.
They didn't. They licensed it. There was no R&D.
They threw money at it.
There was no R&D. There was no.
Now they're going to profit? Are you saying that Merck is now going to profit?
They need to market.
This is pure profit for them. This is pure
profit. But also the market is, they've already got systems in place to bring things to market.
That's what I'm saying.
There's a lot that goes in here. You know how many papers they had to get written, how much clinical trials had to.
But they already have that system in place.
That data is already there, but because the data is there, doesn't mean that it's filed. It doesn't mean that it's approved by the government.
They didn't have to search it. There was no discovery. Okay. They licensed the product that already existed, that was already paid for between Emory and Ridgeback. Okay. So they got it at, you know, I don't know the number that they paid for it, but this is money this is found money.
Yes.
It's a fantastic investment.
It isn't found money.
On the front end,
Mark has 3 years.
And on the front end, they got $1.2 billion for it. So where's the research and where's the discovery? Where is it?
Now, first of all, Merck only has 3 years to monetize this thing. Because in 3 years, it's going to go Canadian pharmacy or wherever. It's going to go.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about $712 per course of treatment for something that only cost them $20 to not only create, but
it is. There's a lot of cost that goes into preparing for the filing.
If you really want to go down a little bit deeper, it doesn't cost them billions of dollars to
yes, there's a lot of cost.
Tell me, show me your cost. Show me your cost.
Okay. First of all, just like there's this
show me your cost that adds up to $712.
There's thousands of drugs that don't come to fruition. 20% of all revenue spent by U.S. drug companies, mind you, goes to R&D. Without that R&D, we wouldn't have our vaccine. We wouldn't have all this stuff that quickly. We wouldn't have had this that quickly. Why? Because it was 90% of the way there. A lot of stuff stops at 90%, and there's money spent on stuff, and you never see dime one. If we wouldn't have had COVID, this money would have just gone goodbye. And it would have just sat there. The patents would exist, but there would be no useful application for the patents. Now, Merck, and I know I'm sounding like poor Merck, but look, Merck only has 3 years to monetize this. This was patented in 2004. In 2024, this patent goes away. That means that every generic can manufacture this. So you've got three years to make money.
Okay,
that is some real like believing in corporate profit. That's what I'm hearing from Lou.
That's what I'm getting ready to say. So scoop the cream off the top before anybody else does. That's what you're saying, right?
Yes. That's what it's like. Those companies are there to make money. I mean, what do you think turns on the lights? What do you think has that machinery going? What do you think has that pipeline going of stuff?
I want figures. Give me some figures.
I just gave you figures.
No, you didn't give me figures. You did not give me figures. No. You're talking about all this paper filing that costs $1.2 billion.
You got to do publishing. Oh God, you got to do clinical trials, a secondary clinical trial on the drug with people with COVID.
I got to tell you, I have to go with Tammy on this one because.
Thank you.
Yes.
Show me your cost.
Yes.
There was no one with COVID in 2004. They had to find people.
This is you being a believer in corporate.
This is completely outrageous.
The goodwill of corporations. There's not goodwill. It's pure profit. And, there's no reason for it to be that kind of price. Why does it have to be like that?
No, there's not one. Not when it costs them $20, $20 a pop. Not even $20, more like $17 and change.
To manufacture, but they had to find people with COVID and do clinical trials with COVID. Do you think those are that easy?
They're not paying people to do these clinical trials. So again, where are your figures, man?
You're paying doctors, you're paying clinics, you're paying for recruitment. You ever hear the commercials? If you've got this and this, you can join our clinical trial. Those things cost money. All of this costs money.
That's not, okay, he's killing
but
me.
But also,
because he's not answering my question.
He's a believer. He's a believer in corporate system and he's a believer. That's all I can say.
And I'm not saying that I'm not a believer in R&D. I'm just saying that there has to be a cutoff, a demarcation for R&D recoupment and gouging the consumer. And this is starting to get not starting to get. These are gouging prices.
It's excessive profit. That's really that's unnecessary.
It's on the back of the phone because they've made the money. Okay, so insulin is $12 in Canada and it's $100 here in the US.
Yeah, that's just about savvy money making by a corporation. They're designed for that and they're profiteering on medical care. I get into a whole issue because, I have a little bit of a beef with that. But Louise, coming from the position of R&D, and if you're going to go through R&D, you got to make money and blah, blah, blah. And okay. All right.
And I get it that insulin's insulin, even though there's like 30 types of insulin right now.
Right.
Depending, but I'm not going to sit
here. You're feeling that it's special because this is really like a one of a kind, the first one out, it's COVID, it's the pandemic.
Yeah, nothing against Canadians. How many drugs have they discovered or brought to market?
That's what he always said.
They didn't create the drug. Over there, they sell you these old products because they have price control. So all they do is like, oh, we've got this 1902 insulin that was discovered by Louis Pasteur or something.
Please tell me how insulin has changed over the years.
It has. I'm not a healthcare provider. Next thing I'll do is tell you to inject Clorox.
I hear the whir of bicycle spokes. That was a backpedal.
I think we're ready for our next story. Or a topic of the day.
So basically, you have not made your case. So we're in agreement that this is complete war profiteering, as you like.
It's war profiteering.
Absolutely.
All right. Yes. Well, now that the queens have summarized this, we do need to take a break. And we'll be right back with this week's topic.
WHIV 102.3 FM.
All right, so we're back. My job is still secure. I was told that I am not fired. I do have opinions.
He had no fingers.
But today, my finger is on the button, so I can just shut this down. So
by the way, a spokesperson from Merck, just to pick up on that last point, a spokesperson from Merck wrote that the company is, quote, committed to providing timely access to molnupiravir globally if it is authorized or approved, and plan to implement a tiered pricing approach based on World Bank data that recognizes countries' relative ability to finance their health response to the pandemic. Sounds good, but let's see what happens.
Show me the money.
Yes.
All right. So now on to this week's topic. So take it away.
And this week's topic is preventive care has been sidelined by the pandemic. In 2020, the arrival of COVID-19 on our shores has had an outsized impact on the U.S. healthcare system. Obviously, the most immediate impact has been the death toll, with the pandemic having taken more than 500,000 lives as of April 16, 2021. Mm-hmm. But the pandemic has also brought a set of healthcare system challenges, chief among them being when and how to resume pre-pandemic preventive healthcare. The question on everyone's mind is how do the risks of leaving home for medical checkups stack up against the risk of infection and possible serious illness or death from exposure to COVID. In March and April of 2020, most medical offices either closed or dramatically scaled back scheduled appointments to the most essential. I actually remember getting calls canceling my appointments during that time.
I remember also, that too.
People also canceled their own appointments in order to avoid interactions and not contract the virus. This included reductions in outpatient visits, emergency room visits, and elective surgeries. So let's take a look at some of the medical services that were sidelined by COVID-19. Obviously, births were not sidelined because you can't schedule.
Can't stop that.
Can't schedule childbirth. But things like mammograms, pap smears, colonoscopies, vaccines, ultrasounds, pelvic ultrasounds, these things, I mean, took a huge hit. You could see from this chart here, and I'm going to have a link to that, that between March and say June of 2020, some of them went into negative 88%. All colonoscopies,
unbelievable,
negative 86%. Pap smears, negative 78%. Mammograms, negative 75%. Childhood immunizations, negative 59%. I mean, that's just to name a few of the really important preventive services that people really need to stay on top of. And by the way, as a result of a lot of these, this lack of preventive care, doctors are now having people who are coming back and coming in with later stage diseases because they didn't keep their 2020 appointment.
Wow.
Yeah, that's awful. I put off mine. Some of my stuff got canceled and then I didn't reschedule it. Colonoscopy, got to schedule that. Breast exam, I didn't get mine done.
At the beginning of COVID, I was so paranoid. We weren't really sure how it was coming. So I was afraid of the mailman. I would, yes. I would avoid that. I was sure that it was coming through my mail. It was in the mail. And we would spray with alcohol. And
was I was doing that too.
Yeah, spray the groceries.
Yes, the groceries. It took forever.
Hazmat suits for everything.
Oh yeah.
So let's not just say that you do is only go to the doctor. Then here in New York City, for whatever reason, people decided that it was Chinese food, and that wasn't helped by the president at all. And a lot of Chinese restaurants closed, some permanently too, some good ones, because people weren't going there because, you know, well, God forbid, you can't eat that kind of food because that has that has COVID, but pizza's safe. You know what I mean? And,
yes.
And it just depends on what insanity. But the thing about medical processes is that it usually involves people. It involves people in close contact,
proximity.
And I don't even think the PAs and NPs were all too keen on.
And we knew so very little back then about the.
And there was no vaccine back then.
No vaccine.
No, there was none. Now the next thing that happened. Now one thing that I did, and I know I'm taking up a lot of time here.
No, please go ahead.
Good stuff.
One of the things I did is I did my own blood work. I just took my stuff to Quest Labs. Can I mention that?
No, you shouldn't.
Oh well.
Just say you took it to a lab.
So I took it to my local lab that I use, and they were able to just give me the blood work, and I looked at the results. And again, I'll do the disclaimer, I'm not a healthcare provider, but they kind of looked normal and they were all within range. And at least I did that much.
Wait, did you go to your primary care physician?
No, he did not go to a primary care. I was getting ready to say, this does not substitute in any way.
How did you get a script? How did you get a script for a blood draw?
Oh, as long as you're paying, they'll do whatever you want.
Yeah,
you only need permission when you want your insurance.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
But you
don't. Oh. So you paid out of pocket.
Yes.
Yeah, I paid out of pocket. Say how much it cost me?
You can say how much it cost.
Okay. I'd be very curious.
It cost $250, and I did the men's metabolic thing. I did my cholesterol. I did about five or six tests that I thought were pertinent to me. And I got all my hormones, my BPH, all that stuff.
$250?
Yeah, for $250. And they give it to you and send you a nice report. And there's plenty of labs that do it. I know I mentioned the one that I went to. But there's at least five or six labs.
They don't go, like, they don't stare at you and go, I don't know how to do this because it's not like in the system. They don't like it. So they're set up.
They are set up to do it.
You can pretty much ask for what you
want.
I'm pretty sure I've never experienced that in New Jersey.
See, when your doctor orders it, the results go back to your doctor.
Right.
When you order it, the results come back to you.
Yeah.
And another benefit, because I know that I just got doctor shamed, but
another benefit. You have to be a doctor to be doctor shamed.
Yes.
You're not a doctor.
Right. But another benefit is that I got my results within, I would say, 48. Supposedly, you get them within 72 hours. Within 48 hours, I had all my results.
But let me ask you a question. Do you really want to entrust your pelvic ultrasound results to just the person who's doing the pelvic ultrasound, or do you want to?
No, that's a great thing. Yes, you cannot.
There's the interpretation of the results.
This is why, this is part of the reason why telehealth has experienced such a boon during this time, because it has eased the path for people to get the care they need without having to go and risk themselves and go into a doctor's office. There's certain things that you just, you know,
cannot outsource. You can't do on your own.
Right,
okay.
Exactly. And you just kind of have to do them. And I think this is why it's so important for people to get vaccinated. I know there's a whole thing going on now with people not wanting to get vaccinated and my body, my choice. I just want to know, is this really the hill people want to die on?
Apparently some people do, but they're determined. But for the rest of us, I'm getting vaccinated is all I'm saying. I'm vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, so just the utter destruction of preventive care and medical services just kind of going down the tube and still hasn't really come back, not properly anyway.
Is it all bottlenecked now? I would think some of these
No, because a lot of people are still,
gun shy.
Yeah. Like, you know, looking at these figures going into to 2021, they still haven't really quite come back. They still haven't. Pap smears, have come back. Mammograms and immunizations have come back, but the numbers are so small. Colonoscopies, only 10% have come back. This is not conducive to overall wellness.
Did you guys slow down in bringing your kids to the pediatrician? You know what I'm saying? Like, I didn't have any, there was no slowdown. My pediatrician's office, I'm very comfortable with. So my little guy got all his shots, no problem. But yeah, they did say that there were some people who were delaying, that they did have that was my personal experience.
Well, what I did was registered her. You know, she stayed in the car. Time, and then they call me, and then go in, so that we're not sitting there
in the waiting room. Yeah, we had that too, with separate entrances and everything. And they were really just super professional about it. It was really smoothly run.
Yeah, the only thing that made me nervous was everything took so long. It was like, look, her appointment is at 5:00. Why are we still here at 5? I don't understand this. You would think you would want us out of here as quickly as possible. But I think part of that might be because, you know, kids weren't necessarily affected the same way adults were affected.
Yes.
You know, although this new Delta variant is hitting children. But they're finding that a lot of those children that have been hit with the Delta, they had underlying conditions. I don't know. Did you read that? I read that. They found that a lot of those children had underlying conditions. But that's not to say you shouldn't still be cautious. But then in any event, answering your question, that's what I did. I did not delay her her care at all.
Well, I'm resuming my healthcare life. That's what's happening over here.
Yes.
But I did delay it. I delayed it.
But a lot of what I do is the telehealth. You know, if I don't have to go in, I'm not going in. And if I have to go in, I'll go in, and I just would make sure to wear my K95 mask. I mean, I am vaccinated, but I make sure to wear my mask. I stay outside for as long as I can. And that's it. You know, when it's time for me to go in, I go in. I don't hang around. But everyone's masked up. It's not like people are like at the supermarket and it's like a mixed bag. Like, everyone in the doctor's office is wearing their
mask. Yes. Yes. What I went for my annual, I remember I said, can I wait outside? And I just stood outside, and I said, I'm a very nervous person. And I just went and stood outside, and she had no problem with that. She called me. It was really easy.
That's so sweet.
Yeah.
I was just like, I'll be outside.
You didn't feel any need to apologize or be shy about it.
Because they understand. They understand. Right. You know, it didn't even need to be explained to them. So I just said, I'll be outside, and I'd wait outside. And then, you know, I would check back periodically if my name was called, and that's it.
Yeah. I would just, you know, changing the topic line a little bit, is that in about 2 years, when, you know, all these diagnostics do catch up, we're going to have a small cancer epidemic. Or we're going to have a lot of stage all of a sudden be diagnosed as stage twos.
Because of this delay.
I don't want to call it the best case scenario, but that would be the best case scenario, that the stage ones become stage twos.
They're already starting to find that from the people who are coming back. So just imagine the people who are delaying into year two, what's going to happen when they decide to come back in year three. And are they going to come back because they finally have symptoms, or are they coming back because it's time?
Yes.
Well, I know what I'm doing after this. One, I'm scheduling my breast exam. Two, I'm scheduling my colonoscopy. And three, I'm throwing out my aluminum deodorant. And so that's my takeaway from today.
Right, right.
But just know that if touch wood, then you don't get anything. But if you do, at least there's hope.
Yes, very good. That's true. That's true.
Well, now that we've closed Mark down, I don't know what, but in terms of diagnostics and everything, yeah. But I think that what we said earlier on all fronts is eat healthy, eat healthier, make sure that weight is controlled, all the things that contribute.
Work out on your stationary bike.
Work out more.
Or take a brisk walk around your neighborhood. Doesn't have to be a shisha yes. bike.
Correct.
Well, you could go to your local playground and you can run around the track, or you can, you know, take your little hand weights. There's things that you can do that don't cost money.
Correct.
To just getting out into the sun and having, you know, some fresh fruit and vegetables instead of, you know, having a burger and fries, you know, back away from some of the comfort food and try to, you know, have more, less processed foods.
Right.
That'll definitely put you in the right direction.
Whole foods, whole food, plant-based. Yeah.
Plant-based is, and red, yeah. you hit it right on the head, which is red meat. You know, nothing wrong with red meat, but it has to be eaten in moderation. It shouldn't be, you know, some doctors saying not more than once or twice a week. That's my belief. I don't know if there's any science.
That's one or two times a week more than I care to eat.
Yeah. That. So, you know.
You're zero red meat. Ooh.
Oh, absolutely. But to each his own.
Yeah.
Look.
Right.
Oh, I had red meat growing up. It was very delicious. But yes. When I became an adult, it just didn't agree with my system. And I just decided to put it aside.
Right. And I can't even, and as a red meat eater, I can't even tell you right now the last time I had red meat.
That's
wow. It's been a while. I have moved to whole food, plant-based. You know,
I have not cheated at Burger King or anywhere.
Wow.
A long time. Did I just mention another brand? Oh my
God. You haven't cheated at the fast food restaurant.
Burger King, McDonald's,
burger
joints. If I mention them all, Jack in the Box, Arby's. So I mentioned you all. So you're all in there.
He's such a child.
Yeah.
But I think definitely people should absolutely see their doctors. Yes. I can't stress that enough. See your doctors, because you can run all the tests and stuff you want, but without preventive care, there is no prevention. Okay?
Yes. Okay. And I do
Sounds
have
good stuff.
Yeah. And I do have one bit of advice that's very timely. Just this morning, McDonald's announced the meat plant. So being that I mentioned some of those names in McDonald's, now there are healthy options and you can actually have a plant-based burger that's supposed to be delicious. It's only going to be introduced in 800 or so of its restaurants nationwide, but if it's a success, it's going to be rolled out worldwide. Burger King is already using Beyond Meat. I've personally tried it, and I'm telling you, according to me,
it is actually quite tasty.
I
did like it. Yeah.
It's just as many calories, which I found disappointing.
Right.
Okay, I'm getting over on it. Now I can order it all the time.
No, getting over.
But, you know,
it's probably easier to digest.
It's plant-based and it's easier to digest, and you're not having that red meat hormone.
You have to meet people where they're at. You know, you can't just say, well, you know.
It's a process. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So there are choices out there, and, you know.
Try to make better choices.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's all the time we have. I had so much fun with you guys today.
I did too.
And I want to thank everyone out there for listening to Urban Health Weekly. And we will see you next week. Bye, guys.
Bye. Bye. See you guys.
Thanks for listening to Urban Health Weekly today. I hope you'll join me and my friends next week so you can stay informed and inspired to take control of your health. See you next time.
Thank you.